Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New York Institute for the Humanities podcast, now affiliated with the New York Public Library. I'm Robert Boynton. In this episode from The Vault, we hear from fashion historian Ann Hollander, a longtime member of the Institute and former president of the Penn American Center. Hollander was the author of Seeing Through Clothes, Moving Pictures, and Sex and Suits, The Evolution of Modern Dress. At the time of her death in 2014, she was working on a book about clothes in literature, which is the subject of this talk.
I don't know anybody else who could have brought out this crowd on this day, except for our favorite, Ann Hollander.
I'm going to talk today about clothes in books, that is to say, clothes as they are represented by writers, poets, and novelists. To take note of how clothes being represented not in pictures manage to survive. There is a way in which you can't tell what you're hearing about. And then there is something that is very vivid indeed. So I'm going to start with the Iliad. I am going to also give you only one kind of description of dress. This is going to be the woman dressed very remarkably. In each case, this is a moment in the Iliad when Juno, Hera, observes that the battle is going against her guise and for her husband's guise, and she realizes that she has to get her husband away from urging the Greeks on so that her fellow can urge the Trojans on. There's a way in which she's trying to interfere with the war in this way. So she decides to seduce her husband away from the field where the mountain where he can see that his troops are actually gaining on the other side. So she looked down, stationed high at her post aloft Olympus's peak, and she saw the sea lord blustering strong and so forth and so on. Her heart was filled with loathing. What could she do? She wondered, her eyes glowing wide. How could she outmaneuver Zeus the mastermind? At last, one strategy struck her mind as best. She would dress in all her glory and go to Ida. Perhaps the old desire would overwhelm the king to lie by her naked body and make immortal love, and she might drift an oblivious wall, soft, warm sleep across his eyes and numb that seething brain. So off she went to her room. Now, we get it. She's going to try to seduce him, and her friend, Sleep, can go and urge on the others that will win the war. Doesn't work, but still. Off she went to her room, the chamber her loving son Hephaestus built her, hanging the doors from doorposts and so on and so forth. She slipped in, closing the polished doors. The ambrosia first. Hera cleansed her enticing body of any blemish. Then she applied a deep olive rub, the breathtaking redolent oil she kept. A perfumed cloud would drift from heaven down to earth. Kneading her skin with this to a soft glow and combing her hair, she twisted her braids with expert hands. Sleek, luxurious, shining down from her deathless head, they fell, and so on. Then round her shoulders she swirled the wondrous robes that Athena wove her, brushed out to a high gloss, and worked into the weft an elegant rose brocade. She pinned them across her breasts with a golden brooch, sashed her waist with a waistband floating 100 tassels, and into her earlobes neatly pierced she quickly looped her earrings. Ripe mulberry clusters dangling in triple drops, and so on and so forth. Then back over her brow, she draped her headdress, fine fresh veils for Hera, the queen of the gods, and so on. Now, dazzling in all her rich regalia, head to foot out of her rooms, she strode and beckoned Aphrodite away from the other gods. Now, what she does, of course, is ask. She's as beautiful as can be imagined, and she's a goddess. However, she knows anything might go wrong, so she asks Aphrodite for Aphrodite's girdle, against which nobody is proof. And Aphrodite says, okay, here it is. She takes it off and she says, stuff it into your bosom. Nothing can go wrong. And sure enough, you know, she says, here now, take this band, put it between your breasts. You won't return your mission unfulfilled, whatever your eager heart desires to do. So Aphrodite went home and she comes down and so on. Then there's a lot of sleep. So that's the end of that scene. It's her wonderful earrings and whatnot that she puts in a perfume cloud, needing her sin. Okay. So there is Homer producing this marvelously accoutred lady. This is the first of all these that I want to show you or read to you, but it is apparently an unquenchable theme in literature, the adorned woman who stops the action while she is adorned or while we look at her or while the author describes what she has on. You find it again and again. Shakespeare is, of course, very, very imitate Homer, if you can manage it. And we have in Antony and Cleopatra, the barge she sat in. So we have the barge with the as a burnished throne, the poop beaten gold, purple the sails, and so forth. And then for her own person, it beggared all description. And so it does, because he doesn't describe it. He says, she lay in her pavilion, cloth of gold, of tissue, or picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outward nature, period. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys and so on, like smiling cupids, with divers colored fans, whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks, which they did cool, and what they undid did. Not another word about what she really looked like, you understand. So that's very clever of Shakespeare. But everybody is gasping and saying, oh, rare for Antony, although we have no idea what she actually looked like. So now we get on another note entirely, the Bible. Who can find a virtuous woman? Her price is far above rubies, and all about how good she is. And she seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. She riseth while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and so forth. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth not out by night. Well, that's very nice. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. She reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, and so on and so forth. Then she maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. And then she maketh fine linen and selleth it and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come, and so forth. Favor is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, that's the silk and purple, and let her own works praise her in the gates. So he's very grudging about what she wears. Silk and purple, that's enough. It's more fun in the comedies. And here we have Much Ado About Nothing, scene 4 of Act 3. And we have Hero, Margaret, and Ursula. And Margaret, the maid, is saying to Hero, the heroine, I like the new tire within excellently. If the hair were a thought browner, and your gown's a most rare fashion face. I saw the Duchess of Milan's gown that they praise so. Oh, that exceeds, says Hero, they say. But a nightgown in respect of yours, cloth of gold and cuts and laced with silver and set with pearls down sleeves, side sleeves and skirts round, underborn with a bluish tinsel. But for a fine, quaint, graceful, and elegant fashion, yours is worth 10 of it. God give me joy to wear it, for my heart is exceeding heavy. One real description, very much in passing. Shakespeare doesn't really do it. I want to keep moving into the rest of the 17th century, where we have the tales of Charles Perrault, Cinderella, and Little Red Riding Hood. These are not folk tales, of course, but literary works. The story of Little Red Riding Hood is exactly 3 short pages. There was once a little girl in a village, the prettiest one that ever saw, anyone ever saw. Her mother was crazy, and so was her grandmother. Her mother made her a beautiful red hood, which became her very well, and everyone called her Le Petit Chaperon Rouge, or Little Red Riding Hood. One day, her mother, as we know, having cooked and made some cakes, said, "Go and see how your grandmother is doing and take her these cakes." And Little Red Riding Hood went immediately to her grandmother's, who lived in a different village. And going through the woods, she encountered the wolf, who was very eager to eat her. But he dared not, because several butchers over there in the forest. And he asked her where she was going. And she said, "I'm going to see my grandmother," and told her exactly where, to give her this cake. The wolf took note of where the grandmother lived and rushed off, and she went off to her grandmother's house. The wolf got there first, and he knocked on the door, and my grandmother said, "Who's there?" And the wolf said, "I am your granddaughter, Little Red Riding Hood," and she let her in. So he went inside, and it says here, "Il se jeta sur la bonne femme et la dévora en moins de rien." And so, car il y avait plus de 3 jours qu'il n'avait mangé. He was very hungry indeed. Then he closed the door and went to got into the bed where the grandmother was. This is all the second of these 3 pages. Knock, 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 who's there? And she said, "It's votre fille, le petit chaperon rouge, qui vous apporte une galette." And the wolf cried out, "Oh, yes, pull the latch." She went right in. And the wolf watched her come in and said, "Put the cake and the pot of butter over there and come and get into the bed with me." And Little Red Riding Hood got undressed and got into the bed, where she was very much astonished to see how her grandmother was made underneath her nightgown, and said, "My goodness, don't you have big arms? It's to embrace you better. My goodness, don't you have great legs? It's to run better. Oh, don't you have big ears? It's to hear you better, my dear. My grandmother, how big eyes you have to see you better. And what big teeth, and it's for eating you." And saying this, the méchant loup se jeta sur le petit chaperon rouge et la mangea. Very elevating, no doubt. Anyway, that's the end. I have always noticed there is no reason for the redness of Little Red Riding Hood's costume. I used to think that you'd find that out if you found the Perrault, and I found the Perrault. Not a word about the redness. That's the 17th century. In the 18th, however, I have a real prize for you. This is a section of that great work, Clarissa, which has letters, of course, only, undertakes the dreadful seduction of this glorious virgin. And so we have the letter that is written by Lovelace, the villain and hero, to his friend, and says, "Expect here a faint sketch of her admirable person with her dress, and then a lot about her flesh, and the ringlets of her shining hair, and so on, needing neither art nor powder. Her headdress was a Brussels lace mauve, peculiarly adapted to the charming air and turn of her features. A sky blue ribbon illustrated that. But although the weather was somewhat sharp, she had not on either hat or hood. Besides that, she loves to use herself hardily by a temperance truly exemplary. She is allowed to have given high health and vigor to an originally tender constitution. She seems to have intended to show me she was determined not to go out," in other words. Her morning gown was a pale primrose-colored paduasoy, that's peau de soie. The cuffs and robings curiously embroidered by the fingers of this clever, charming Arachne in a running pattern of violets in their leaves. You can imagine his correspondent getting somewhat bored by this. The light in the flowered silver, gold in the leaves. A pair of diamond snaps in her ears. A white handkerchief wrought by the same inimitable fingers. Concealed, oh, Belford, what still more inimitable beauties did it not conceal? And I saw, all the way we rode, the bounding heart by its throbbing motions. Her ruffles were the same as her mob, her apron a flowered lawn, her coat, that's a petticoat, white satin, quilted, blue satin her shoes, braided with the same color, without lace. I mean, this is really amazing. For what need has the prettiest foot in the world of ornament? Neat buckles in them. On her charming arms, a pair of black velvet glove-like muffs of her own invention, for she makes and gives fashions as she pleases. Her hands, velvet of themselves, thus uncovered, the freer to be grasped by those of her adorer. There's more about this encounter, but meanwhile, poor Belford has had to spend minutes reading about her clothes, and this is all in aid of pleasing the public, no doubt, generally female, that I believe he was aiming this book at, and who all wanted, he thought, to have descriptions of what everybody wore. And there are a lot of other descriptions in the novel about what everybody else wore, too, all of them girls in various kinds of dress. Now, in that same century at the other end, we have Mansfield Park. Jane Austen never gives the description of anybody's clothing whatsoever. The only descriptions of clothing in Jane Austen are given by a character about another character or to another character. She has sometimes the narrator or a protagonist talk about somebody else's dress, but she herself does not, in her authorial role, ever give a description of what anyone has on. It's all part of the character that is perceiving it that she writes. The scene I'm interested in is in Mansfield Park, which is a very complicated book. And we have Edmund, the stuffy man whom Fanny, the stuffy girl, is going to fall in love with and marry. And we're all glad they're pairing off because both of them are a little unbearable and all the interesting characters are not the principal ones. So we're glad they get together and we know they will. "Now I must look at you, Fanny," said Edmund, with the kind of smile of an affectionate brother, "and tell you how I like you, and as well as I can judge by this light, you look very nicely indeed. What have you got on?" "The new dress that my uncle was so good as to give me on my cousin's marriage. I hope it is not too fine, but I thought I ought to wear it as soon as I could," and so on and so forth. Edmund, "A woman can never be too fine while she is all in white. No, I see no finery about you, nothing but what is perfectly proper. Your gown seems very pretty. I like these glossy spots. Has not Miss Crawford a gown something like that?" Poor Fanny realizes that her Edmund that she sighs for is much more taken by Miss Crawford anyway, so it doesn't do her any good to have her dress admired if it is also compared to Miss Crawford's. That's the end of that scene entirely, but it is very striking. "A woman can never be too fine when she wears white," is a little principle in there. All right, so much for Jane. Here's Werther by Goethe. And this is a famous scene. "I climbed out of the coach. The maid who came to the gate asked us to wait a moment. Mademoiselle Lutchen would soon be down. He's taking this girl to a party. He's never seen her before, but he's promised to pick her up en route. When I came in, I saw the most charming scene I ever had in my life beheld. In the entrance hall, 6 children between the ages of 11 and 2 swarming around a handsome young girl of medium height who wore a simple white dress with pink bows on her arms and breast." And that's it. She wears that, and he never has it out of his head, and he remembers it on his deathbed. It is the dress for anyone who wants to be infinitely attractive to wear. And the white dress with the pink bows, he remembers all the way through until he dies. So it's a lesson for anybody reading that you can wear a white dress with pink bows, and it will have that kind of an effect. I don't know if anybody followed it. 1774, Jane Austen's Mansfield Park was 1814, Clarissa, 1747. Here's Hemingway, The Sun Also Rises. He wore what used to be called polo shirts at school and may be called that still, but he was not professionally youthful. This is 1925. 100 pages later, he lay there in his white shirt on the bed, in the dark, his polo shirt, the polo shirt. That's all about that. Anyway, this is modern life. You need only three words instead of three stanzas. Next, The Great Gatsby. There's this great notice about Jordan Baker, the infinitely attractive heroine. She got up slowly, raising her eyebrows at me in astonishment, and followed the butler towards the house. I noticed that she wore her evening dress, all her dresses, like sports clothes. There was a jauntiness about her movements, as if she had first learned to walk upon golf courses in them on clean, crisp mornings. That's pretty good, too. Yes, Daisy came out of the house, and two rows of brass buttons on her dress gleamed in the sunlight. That's all. What I should have and don't have for you, but recommend, is Henry James, who throughout will do in half a sentence what some of these authors feel they need a whole paragraph to tell you something about. Some of that is like Hemingway, and some of that is like Fitzgerald. Now, one more moment, and I'll be done. Reluctant to appear to interrogate her, I merely looked her way. Her sensual presence was strong. Perhaps she kept herself on the thin side so it wouldn't be stronger. Or maybe so it would, since her breasts weren't those of an undernourished woman. She wore jeans and a low-cut lacy silk blouse that resembled a little lingerie top. That was a little lingerie top, I realized upon looking again, and wrapping her torso was a longish cardigan with a thick edge of wide ribbing and a tie of the same ribbing at the other end of the spectrum of female apparel from the hospital gown Amy Billette had converted into a dress. The sweater could easily have cost $1,000, and she looked languid wearing it, languid and in enticing repose as though she were wearing a kimono. She spoke rapidly and quietly, as highly complicated people will do, under pressure particularly. Beneath the blazer, this is entirely different and a different woman, beneath the blazer, she wore a ribbed black cashmere turtleneck that was also close-fitting, as were the dark denim jeans that flared just a bit at the bottom, probably to accommodate the boots. To walk around the apartment, she had put on a pair of flat shoes that looked like ballet slippers. Though the calculation was subtle, she didn't look as if she were necessarily pursuing guileless ends by the way she dressed, or as if she lacked confidence in her power to arouse the admiration of men. Did she care one way or another whether I was as wowed as the others? If not, why had she gotten herself up so appealingly just to go for the groceries and watch the election results? Though maybe any unknown guest would have prompted her to choose to wear something attractive. Now that's a wonderful, endless passage about the effect of what somebody wears. Same, I mean, that's another woman getting dressed, only it's the man thinking, goodness, look at the way she looks. This whole subject, that is, descriptions of clothes in novels or in all of fiction, is all part of the book I'm writing that includes Homer and goes all the way up to whoever is writing books at the time I finish, which may be some while off. So thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the New York Institute for the Humanities and the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. For more information, visit us at nyihumanities.org.